We can't completely control the fate of our bodies after we die. People have their last wishes, things they wish to be done to their remains, and if you're famous, those last requests can be quite the production. And no, we're not just talking about the psychedelic drug advocate Timothy Leary's ashes being blasted off into space, though that is one of the stories. I'm Suzanne Hogan, and today on Central Standard, we'll hear how Einstein's brain took a road trip across America, how people flocked from around the world to see the alleged holy whisker of the Prophet Muhammad, and how the body of St. Nicholas became a powerful relic that fueled a long custody battle between two Italian towns. The fates and stories of famous bodies and their lasting impact on the living. Just after this hour's news. Albert Einstein said to his biographer, quote, "I want to be cremated so people don't come to worship at my bones," end quote. He didn't even want a funeral. There was no funeral when Einstein died in 1955, and most of Einstein's body was cremated, except for one important part, his brain. Pathologist Dr. Thomas Harvey, who was helping with the autopsy, believed that there was a great scientific value in studying Einstein's brain. Harvey eventually successfully convinced his family of this decision, which led to Einstein's brain taking a road trip across the nation. Research was performed, a few amazing things discovered, and finally, 50 years later, Einstein's remains came to rest, partly at Princeton Hospital and at the Mutter Museum in Philadelphia. Good morning and welcome to Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Suzanne Hogan. Today, the stories of the fates of famous people's bodies after they've passed away. Some in compliance with their wishes, some a strange hybrid, and others not even close. From Joan of Arc, Graham Parsons, good old St. Nicholas, Eva Perón, also known as Evita, Abraham Lincoln, and a lot more. Our guest today has been researching the strange and unexpected stories about what has happened to the bodies of famous icons after they die, and what it tells us about their lasting influence and legacies to the living after they've gone. Joining us today from KUOW in Seattle, Bess Lovejoy, author of the recently released Rest in Pieces, The Curious Fates of Famous Corpses. Bess Lovejoy, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
Beth is a writer, researcher, and editor based in Seattle. She likes to write about dead people and forgotten histories, among other things. Bess, let's start first by quickly finishing the story of Albert Einstein's brain, which has a bit of a local connection. Dr. Thomas Harvey at one point resided in Wichita and later retired in Lawrence, Kansas. So what's the story behind Harvey's relationship to Einstein's brain?
Sure. Yeah, it's a pretty interesting and complicated story. So I don't know how much your researchers will know about it. There have been a few different books on the subject, but as you mentioned, Einstein wanted to be cremated, and for the most part, that was carried out. But during the autopsy, Thomas Harvey took it upon himself to take out Einstein's brain, and he didn't really have permission from the family to be doing that. But at the time, in the 50s, it wasn't all that unusual for doctors performing autopsies to take any organ that they thought would be interesting for them to study, and they didn't really feel that they needed permission from the family to do that. So Harvey took Einstein's brain, and Otto Nathan, who was Einstein's executor, and then I believe it was also Einstein's son, got very upset about that. But eventually, Thomas Harvey did get permission to keep the brain and study it. But the trouble was that he didn't really have a background in neuroanatomy himself to be studying Einstein's brain and trying to figure out if there were any qualities in it that made Einstein the amazing genius that he was. So he basically ended up keeping it in his closet for a long time. And soon after the autopsy, he was actually fired from the hospital, or he left the hospital. And it's not 100% clear to me how that all went down. Some people say it was because of the business with Einstein's brain. Others say there were other reasons. And so after he was fired, he ended up kind of going all around the country, taking Einstein's brain with him as he moved from job to job and house to house. And he would keep it in his closet and underneath, his socks at one point, and boxes. But eventually he did start giving samples of it to scientists to study. And in the early 80s, some interesting reports came out. I believe the first one was by a professor at Berkeley, and she was looking at the glial cells in Einstein's brain, which are cells that nourish neurons. And she noticed an unusually high number of these kinds of cells in Einstein's brain, and she has some theories about why that might have been significant. And there have been other theories around the size and shape of Einstein's brain. But the trouble is we don't really have a lot of other, or really any other, Einsteins to compare his brain with. So there's not a, you know, a bank of genius brains waiting out there to be studied. So it's difficult sometimes to say whether any particular feature of Einstein's brain was important or not. And actually now slides of Einstein's brain are in several different places. I'm not sure anyone is quite clear on where they all are. But what I think is quite wonderful is that in 2011, I believe it was 40 or so of the slides did go on display at the Mutter Museum in Philadelphia. So you can go and see them and make some conclusions for yourself.
Was Dr. Harvey advertising the fact that he had Einstein's brain in his possession this whole time while he was traveling across America?
I think at first he was quite skeptical and hesitant about doing that because there was so much controversy over what he'd done. It was reported in the major media right afterwards that Einstein's brain was being studied, and that's when the family and the executor got so upset about all of this. So at first, no, but I think gradually word got out into the scientific community, and you know, there were a lot of requests. So the autopsy was 1955, and then Harvey initially gave a couple samples out to people he knew and trusted, and not much came out of those studies. But then I don't think it was really until the late 70s or so that he started to be in contact with most people. So he certainly wasn't going around putting billboards up about it.
So this topic you've written about can seem initially kind of morbid, but as you read more into the material, it reveals an interesting idea about how societies have changed the ways they view death, mourning, and what to do about the bodies of the dead. And I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about that.
Sure, yeah. It's a fairly complicated topic because our attitudes to the body have changed just so much over time. And that was something I didn't expect to find so much about out about while I was doing the research. But one of the things that I thought was really striking was how people used to be much more comfortable touching corpses than we are now. And we had a great book release party here in Seattle last night. And one of the things I spent some time talking about was relics and the whole tradition of the relics of saints. When it was thought that something like, you know, touching a cloth into the blood of a martyr and then touching it to yourself was a way of healing yourself. And people claimed, for instance, after the Archbishop of Canterbury, Thomas Becket, was murdered, you know, they said that his blood had made the blind able to see again and cured all kinds of illnesses. And St. Nicholas, who's in the book, there's a great tradition of his bones exuding what's called mana or myrrh, bone oil, which is a liquid that chemically seems to be water, but people claim it has all kinds of healing properties, and people have actually, you know, drunk it over time. So that's quite interesting, and something I think certainly most modern Americans would not be interested in doing. We tend to want to be as far away from corpses as possible, for the most part. I mean, I personally, despite writing about all of this, I've never even seen a dead body, and I don't know that I would want to. But there used to be a tradition of, you know, the woman of the house bathing the corpse afterwards and being very involved in taking care of the dead and making sure they got a proper burial. These days, we are more than happy to leave that up to professionals for the most part. So that's one of the major areas I think that's changed, is just our reluctance, extreme reluctance to actually interact with the dead at all.
So you've never actually seen a corpse. How did you go about studying this? And I guess why the interest in this topic then?
Well, I should note, I've seen a lot of corpses on video, you know, and in various History Channel documentaries, but never one in front of me. Why the interest? Well, you know, I wouldn't say that I was a morbid kid, but certainly by about my mid-teens, I became just kind of interested in how people approached the idea of their own mortality and just their finality, you know, and the idea that one day this life that we all enjoy is going to come to an end. So it was never really like blood or gore or, you know, I wasn't into serial killers or anything like that, but just the idea of death and dying has kind of interested me for a long time. And In 2008, I was working on a series of books called Schott's Almanac, which with a wonderful British author named Ben Schott. And we spent a lot of time reading the news and trying to come up with interesting stories to write about. And there were two stories that came across my desk within, I think, about a day or two of each other. Like I said, I think this was December 2008. And the first story was about the pianist Andrei Tarkovsky, who had willed his skull to the Royal Shakespearean Theatre Company for use in Hamlet. And I later discovered there's actually a tradition, usually of actors trying to get their skulls used in the Alas, Poor Yorick scene of Hamlet, and it's sort of seen as an honor. But at the time, I thought that was pretty bizarre. And the reason it was in the news is that Tarkovsky had died some time ago, but finally his skull, after being properly cleaned and I think even kept on a roof for a while, was actually being used in, you know, several performances by the Royal Shakespearean Theatre Company, and people thought that was pretty bizarre. And I thought it was fairly bizarre, but interesting. And then the next day or so, I read an article also in the British press about the painter Francis Bacon, who was a notoriously dark and macabre painter. And he had said, when I die, put me in a plastic bag and throw me in the gutter. And he did die in Madrid, and he was with a friend of his who was a photographer. And she did take a body, she did take a picture of his body in, I believe it was like the plastic bag at the morgue. And she used it in an art show to raise money for Bacon's favorite club in Soho in London, his favorite bar, basically. And so that really fascinated me because I got so curious about last wishes, and particularly the last wishes of famous, you know, writers, because I'm a writer, and artists and musicians and just, you know, intellectual heroes of mine. And I thought, well, what could we learn about people by figuring out what they wanted to have happen after they died? But then as I started doing the research, I discovered that often what people wanted to have happen wasn't what happened, and that a lot of the interesting stories were not so much about, you know, wills and last wishes, but actually the terrible problems and crazy adventures of people's corpses that they didn't plan for and they didn't expect. And I began to think, well, this could be a really interesting book. And then it became a book. So it was, you know, it was partly born out of the interest in death and dying, but it was also born out of an interest in history and just a love of doing research in general.
You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Suzanne Hogan. Today's topic, the stories of what has become of famous people's bodies after they've died. We're talking to Bess Lovejoy, author of Rest in Pieces, The Curious Fates of Famous Corpses. So let's get back to that idea about what people wanted when they died versus what actually happened to them. And one of my favorite little snippets of a story that's in the book is Marquis de Sade, who wanted to be buried in the woods with acorns scattered over his grave, but he ended up just being buried in the cemetery of the insane asylum where he died. What were some of your other favorites that kind of have that theme of not really being what the person wanted to have done?
Right. Well, I would say that most of the stories in the book, with the exception of Jeremy Bentham, the philosopher, until you get into the 20th century, most of the stories are not so much about what people wanted to have happen, but what did happen and the ways that things went wrong. But one of the stories I thought was kind of interesting was around Lord Byron and how he kind of went back and forth throughout his life about whether or not he wanted to be buried in England, because he died when he was in Greece and he was actually fighting for the independence of Greece from the Ottoman Empire. And he contracted malaria. You know, many experts think it was malaria in the Greek marshlands, and he passed away. But by the end of his life, he was pretty sure that he did not want to go back to England, and he definitely did not want an autopsy. He referred to this as his body being hacked. So he said, "Let not my body be hacked or carried back to England." And he even said something about how he didn't think his bones could ever rest in English soil. And this was partly because he'd been a very controversial figure in England, and he'd been more or less kind of kicked out during a whole scandal. Those wishes were totally ignored. Basically, his friends and others around him decided he was definitely having an autopsy and his body was definitely going back to England, which is completely not what he wanted. And they tried to get him buried in Westminster Abbey, which is, of course, this very hallowed resting ground for famous Brits. And the people at Westminster completely refused because of the scandal. And so there was actually no memorial or mention of Lord Byron at all in Westminster Abbey until I think it was 1969 or thereabouts, when attitudes to Byron, and to libertine behavior started to relax a little bit. Mm-hmm.
I want to get into you sectioned the book off into various sections, one of them being saints and sinners. And you kind of mentioned St. Nicholas before, but I'd like for you to get a little bit more into that story and the idea of relics, like you proposed, this idea that the dead or parts of the dead could heal the living. And it created a lot of controversy, even to this day. Can you speak a little bit more about the fate of St. Nicholas?
Sure. Well, and I think the interesting thing, just to get into the idea of relics real quickly, is that, you know, I personally am not Catholic. I was actually raised as a Jew, and we don't really have relics in Judaism. So it was kind of a strange thing for me to even wrap my head around. But the idea of relics, as far as I can understand, seems to be that they are a way of communicating with the divine. So I say in the book that they seem to me to kind of function like spiritual walkie-talkies. So you can communicate to the divine through them, and the saint can intercede on your behalf and perform miracles for you, heal you, etc. So it's interesting to me because it's not so much that the piece of the body has any specific, like, magical power, but it can be kind of a way of talking to the saint and maybe talking to God. So St. Nicholas is really interesting because we don't know all that much about the man who was St. Nicholas. And many of your listeners will probably know that St. Nicholas is generally thought to be the inspiration for Santa Claus. But back in the day, he lived in what is now Turkey. I think he's said to have died about 350 AD, but we were not really certain. He was very well loved by the populace in that part of the world. And soon after he died, he was thought to be a kind of saint for sailors. So when sailors would be in rough waters, they would call out his name and watch the seas, you know, mysteriously smooth is what I say in the book. And the whole sort of cult of devotion around him arose. And the interesting thing is that at that point, when you had the body of a popular saint, that really brought a lot of prestige to your town and also a lot of money, because pilgrims would come. They'd make pilgrimages to the tomb. So you'd have this whole tourist trade, and people would leave donations, etc. So St. Nicholas's tomb got really popular and drew, you know, pilgrims from throughout Europe. And then I believe it was around 1170 or so, the little town of Bari in southern Italy, which is sort of like at the heel of the boot of Italy, a group of merchants, I believe it was, decided that they were going to steal a saint for themselves because the town didn't have a saint. Major saints, the relics of a major saint, and they wanted to bring, you know, that kind of power and prestige to their town. And also they had recently been invaded by the Normans, and so I believe the Norman leaders of the town were also interested in having the relics of a saint as a way of kind of uniting the town. So it seems to me to function a little bit like a sports team. You know, if you have a major sports team, you can kind of get people to rally around that, and they think of it as a major point of pride. So Bari wanted the relics of St. Nicholas to work kind of the same way. So a whole boatload of merchants and sailors and others showed up, and the town was called, I think it was still called Mira at that point, in what is now Turkey. And basically these guys from Bari just kind of smashed their way into St. Nicholas's tomb. And when they did so, this scent of his mana, his bone oil, this liquid that his relics are immersed in, kind of wafted up from them and enveloped them. And there's an account, I think it's a 13th century account from a clerk in Bari about what happened. And he says that the scent licked the men from Bari as if in an insatiable embrace. So it was this, you know, supposedly very sensual moment, and that overwhelming aroma was actually seen as a sign that the saint wanted to go with the men from Bari. And there were other symbols supposedly of that as well. So they made off with the bones of St. Nicholas and brought him back to Bari, built a beautiful basilica for him, became very popular. The men who had actually gotten together to take the relics from Mera became famous in the town. They got a lot of money because of it. But the interesting thing is that not long afterwards, some merchants from Venice actually decided to go and steal Nicholas also. And you wouldn't think there would have been anything of Nicholas left to steal, but apparently there were still a couple fragments of bones and they took those. So even to this day, the people in Venice will tell you, we have St. Nicholas. And the people in Bari will tell you, we have St. Nicholas. And actually, there's also churches all over the world who claim to have some part of St. Nicholas, whether it's, you know, a finger or a tooth or a piece of hair. So, and relics do spread around the world that way. But it's usually, there is one large repository of the person's body, and both Bari and Venice claim to have it.
And the controversy lives on today. There's even some examples of people going to great lengths to avoid immortalizing the remains. And I'm thinking of the story of Joan of Arc. Could you tell us that story?
Sure. Yeah, that's an interesting one, because I was surprised to discover that after Joan of Arc was burned at the stake, she was such a controversial figure that the people who burned her decided to burn her again, because they wanted to make sure that no one would collect any relics of her. They did not want her to continue to be worshipped. And you can kind of see that actually with other political corpses throughout history, this prevention of the creation of a shrine or any kind of grave site that people can go to. And so they burned her twice. And then I believe they threw what was left into the river, into the Seine, I think it was. And what's interesting, though, is that at some point in the 19th century, a pharmacist claimed to have discovered a piece of Joan of Arc that no one had ever found before. And I think he might have said it was a leg bone. I'm not too sure what he thought it was. But this was very exciting for some Catholics in France. And they were really moved by the idea of having Joan of Arc's relics. But then a scientist in France recently, just a couple of years ago, performed some forensic analysis of that, and he discovered that it was a cat bone, I believe. I think it was an ancient Egyptian cat bone from a cat mummy, I think is what it was. So quite old, which is really fascinating and interesting piece of history in and of itself, but not a piece of Joan of Arc. So I thought that was really fascinating, and also just that people would go so far as to burn her twice simply for the idea of making sure no one could collect any part of her body.
So it's unknown where the remains of Joan of Arc lay to this day.
No one knows. I mean, they probably were just totally dispersed in the river, and you could think of them as kind of nourishing the ground there, but there's no grave for her.
If you have a question for Bess Lovejoy, author of Rest in Pieces, The Curious Fates of Famous Corpses, about her research, or do you have a local connection to Dr. Thomas Harvey, who retired in Lawrence and is known for keeping Einstein's brain, give us a call, 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or send us an email at centralstandard@kcur.org. Moving away from the Catholic Church, there's a story in the book about a shrine in Kashmir, India, that is said to have the plucked hair from the beard of the Prophet Muhammad. And I was really surprised to read about that. What's the story there? Is that true?
Well, you know, no one has ever done any kind of DNA analysis on this, so I'm not really in a position to comment whether or not that's true. But certainly many believers believe very fervently that is true. And actually, if anyone is interested in this story and other stories about relics, I would really would actually recommend another book called Rag and Bone by the wonderful author Peter Manso. And he actually goes to this shrine where the whisker from the Prophet Muhammad is said to be cast. kept, and visits it and hangs out with the keepers of the shrine. And what's interesting about that is I believe it was in the 60s, the hair was supposedly stolen from the shrine, and there were mass protests around the region, and everyone was very upset until it was recovered. But, you know, certainly there's been no scientific committee saying yes or no, this is definitely a hair from the Prophet Muhammad. But that's the way it is with most relics. It's an article of faith, literally and figuratively. We don't have scientific certainty most of the time about what is actually there.
Yeah, a lot of the stories accompany kind of these rumors and have elements of folklore. Yeah. So I'm wondering, how did you go about researching this and identifying credible sources?
Yeah, it was. I would say the research was very, very difficult, and I wish that it had had quite a bit longer to do the research. You know, and I often couch things as a story or as a legend in the book, just because that's all that we know. And to actually uncover some of these mysteries and really get down to the bottom of them would take quite a bit of time and resources. What I chose to do, for the most part, I used several different types of research, but I would often look to the most respected biographer of a given person, and then read as much as I could about the last part of the individual's life and look at the sources that biographer has cited. And when the story is pretty controversial, so for instance with Hitler's remains, where there's not a lot of certainty about what ended up happening, I just followed the most renowned and respected biographer, looked at their sources, and also tried to look in the medical literature as well to see if this had ever been covered. And there's, you know, a whole field of biohistorians who specifically look at this kind of thing. And then in a couple of cases, the most recent stories, the 20th century stories, were much easier to research. And like with Graham Parsons, there's a book written by the road manager who's, you know, burned Graham Parsons' body. So once we get into more recent times, you have people at the deathbed and the death scenes and actually disposing the bodies. And that was much more recent and easier to do. But as I said, I tried to express that a lot of times these are stories. We're not actually going to get to the bottom of what actually did happen. But I tried to compare and contrast stories and form them into a coherent narrative. And if things seemed really bizarre, to just say, well, this is a rumor. We really don't know if this is true. Does that answer your question?
Oh, definitely. And actually, it kind of skips forward to, I wanted to get to some of the more modern day stories, but you mentioned Graham Parsons. Would you mind telling us the story of Graham Parsons, what happened to his body?
Oh, sure. So Graham Parsons, who was this famous rocker, is known for kind of creating the genre of country rock, which I think he liked to call cosmic Americana in the 70s. And he was in the Byrds and a couple of other bands. And he used drugs, and he died of a morphine overdose, actually, out in Joshua Tree in California. But before he died, this was in the late 70s, by the way, before he died, he had made a pact with his road manager that whichever guy died first would take the other guy's body out to Joshua Tree, douse it in gasoline, and burn it. And the reason that they made that pact is because another friend of theirs had recently passed away, I think in a car crash, and they were at his funeral. It was this very formal, stuffy Catholic affair. And they were like, this does not reflect this guy's life at all. This is not how we want to go. If we go, we're going to burn each other. So Graham Parsons, unfortunately, did die of an overdose. And his road manager, I think his name is Phil Kaufman, decided to carry out Graham's last wish, which was not what Graham's family wanted to do. Yeah. So it was Graham Parsons' father who, you know, collected his body after the overdose and tried to get it on a plane from L.A. out to, I think it was New Orleans, which was where Bob Parsons' hometown was, and he wanted to have a funeral there. So Phil Kaufman, Graham Parsons' roadie, decided to steal the body. So he and a friend actually borrowed a hearse from another friend. It was a red Cadillac hearse, I think, that this friend of theirs used for camping trips. And they got totally liquored up, and they went to LAX, and they there doesn't seem to have been that much security around the body, and they just managed to convince the people at the hangar that they were legitimate, and they got the body and they threw it in the back of the hearse and they drove off to Joshua Tree and kept on drinking. And there's a story that when Phil Kaufman opened the hearse in Joshua Tree, and pulled out the coffin and kind of banged on the ground, and he was like, "Oh, sorry, Graham." And they kind of messed around with the corpse just a little bit, but then they did douse it in gasoline and burned it. But it was quite late at night at that point, and they saw some car lights in the distance, and they got kind of spooked. They were super paranoid. They thought the police were after them, so they just left the body by the side of the road and just left it burning. And when some police found it the next morning, and I don't envy those policemen, they had no idea what they were looking at. They didn't know this was Graham Parsons. But eventually, you know, the word got out, and I don't think Phil Kaufman had kept it particularly quiet. So the police did show up at his house, and he kind of joked that they were arresting him for Graham theft Parsons, and he made it into a whole big thing. And eventually, I can't remember whether or not he got jail time, but there was definitely a fine.
Yeah, and his family wasn't very happy, even though it was...
No, his family was not happy. They did not consider that a respectful way to go. You know, and I don't think Graham Parsons had really, I don't think he'd really ever written this wish down anywhere. So even though his friends said, oh yeah, this is what he wanted, you know, his family disagreed. They were not pleased. And I think they were also not pleased by the fact that after the criminal trial, Phil Kaufman went and had a big fundraiser for himself, and he... I can't remember what it's called, but he had sort of like a horror punk band playing, and he made a lot of jokes about the whole thing, and the family thought it was pretty tasteless all around.
We're going to take a call from Gay and Liberty before we go to a break. Gay, welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you. I was in Westminster Abbey this summer, and our guide told us that Dickens had not wished to be there because he felt it was anathema to the writings and the poverty that he had portrayed, but that Queen Victoria had overruled him. Is that
interesting?
Is that something you've come across in your research?
You know, I didn't look too much at Dickens, so I have not heard that story. The one thing I remember reading about Dickens was that he didn't want anyone to wear black at his funeral, because he didn't want that kind of somber funeral, which I thought was interesting. I hadn't heard that story, but it doesn't surprise me that much, because often people have, you know, throughout history have had their wishes overruled in ways like that. So it kind of sounds familiar, but I haven't come across that anecdote. That's really interesting. Thank you for sharing that.
We're going to take a break. When we return, we'll continue our conversation with Bess Lovejoy, author of Rest in Pieces, The Curious Fates of Famous Corpses. We'll hear about some lasting power of the bodies of politicians, the fate of famous heads, plus some pop culture icons of the 20th century. Stay with us. Central Standard will return in just a moment. Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Suzanne Hogan. Today we're talking with Bess Lovejoy, author of Rest in Pieces, The Curious Fates of Famous Corpses. If you're just joining us, we've been talking about the fates of St. Nicholas, Graham Parsons, Albert Einstein, and a lot more. And we're going to get into some politicians and some more modern day stories. But first, Bess, I'm wondering, could you talk about the fate of some of the famous people's heads? It's kind of a crazy thing to think about now, but it's almost like you could have written a whole book about the fate of famous people's heads, which seems like a crazy thing now, but that wasn't such a crazy thing in the past. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Yeah. Thank you, Suzanne. It's it's pretty interesting. I think one of the things that really has led to a whole rash of head stealing, and generally it's the stories about heads and skulls in the book, but some of the best stories are about the skulls. And you can kind of trace this back to this 19th century pseudoscience called phrenology. And there is a great book called Craniocleptie by a man named Colin Dickey, who has written all about this about phrenology and how this led to the theft of famous skulls throughout the land. Well, throughout Europe, anyway. And phrenology was this idea that the brain would change according to someone's personality, the size and shape of the brain would change, and that would affect the size and shape of their skull. So you could actually read someone's skull the way you might, you know, read a palm if you were a palmist. And just by looking at them and feeling their skull, you could determine whether they were, you know, moral or immoral, or whether they were prone to theft, or if they liked to save their money or sleep around. So what happened was, in Vienna, particularly, especially with some famous musicians, people got kind of interested in taking a look at their skulls to see if they carried these characteristics that were associated with certain faculties of the brain. So one of the stories in the book that I like the best is about the composer Joseph Haydn.
Oh, good. I love it's one of my favorites.
Haydn is just irresistible, because the thing about Haydn is, sometimes you have stories where it's people who are totally unconnected to the body who dig it up and make off with the skull. In Haydn's case, a good friend of his was a phrenologist. His name was Johann, Rosenbaum was the last name, Joseph Carl Rosenbaum. And he was interested in Haydn. The two were good friends. And he wanted to find out whether Haydn had what's called the organ of tune, which was a bump, I think, around the edge of your eye that was supposed to be there if you were really wonderful at music. So Rosenbaum and a friend conspired to dig up Haydn's head right after Haydn's death, and they bribed the grave digger to do that. And I think at that point Napoleon was in the midst of invading Vienna, so the grave digger had just had all of his possessions stolen by Napoleon's soldiers, and he was in a pretty good mood to bargain with Rosenbaum. So he did, in fact, dig up Haydn, poor Haydn, and take off his skull and present it to Rosenbaum. This was at the cemetery late at night, and when Rosenbaum saw the head, he threw up. That was all he could do. But he gave the head to a doctor friend who cleaned it and took off all of the flesh and everything, and made it actually into kind of this beautiful, clean, white object, and installed it in this wooden display case that Rosenbaum kept at his house. But word got back to the police pretty quickly that this had gone down. So the Vienna police came knocking on Rosenbaum's door and demanded the skull back. And Rosenbaum basically, he fessed up. He said, "Oh, yes, I did do that, right." But instead of giving them the real skull, he actually gave them a decoy skull.
He just had one lying around?
Apparently. I don't know. I think, I have to say, I don't know how professional the Viennese police were in this case. I think that Rosenbaum knew they were coming, and he prepared, and I don't know whose skull he got, but apparently it was a much younger skull. Haydn died when he was an old man. He lived a rich, long life. But this decoy skull was something of a much younger person. So eventually, the police did discover that they had been fooled, but they never did manage to get Haydn's real head back, and Rosenbaum kept it for his whole life, gave it to the friend who had helped him steal it, and then it actually went to a number of places, and it was only in, I want to say, like around 1961 that Haydn's head was reunited with his body in his tomb in Austria. But the funny thing is that the decoy skull is also supposed to still be there. So Haydn's tomb has two skulls inside, which is pretty crazy. And we don't know if Rosenbaum ever studied the brain, or if he discovered that organ of tune or not. We don't know if that was satisfying to him. But yeah, poor Haydn.
Other head stories in the book include Walt Whitman, Geronimo, and then almost George Washington. What almost happened to the head of George Washington?
Right. Well, that's an interesting story. I talk about that in the context of Abraham Lincoln's story, and I was trying to figure out whether there were any other presidential body thefts. But the story with that is that after George Washington died, I can't remember exactly how long after it was. I think it was around 1830. One of his someone on the staff fired its gardener from the location of the tomb in Mount Vernon, and disgruntled gardener. I don't know why he wanted to do this, but he thought he was going to go back into the crypt and steal George Washington's skull. But somehow he didn't know which skull to steal, so he ended up making off with the, I think it was like the nephew of one of George Washington's in-laws. Totally, totally wrong skull. And he did come back a couple days later, I think it was, and return it. So George Washington's skull is safe and sound. But the funny thing about that is that in his will, Washington had actually asked for a new tomb to be built at Mount Vernon. And he said, okay, the place where people are normally being buried on this estate is old and dilapidated. Please construct a better, more secure one. And that was kind of ignored until this attempted skull theft. And after that, they did give him a much better, nicer tomb. And I think tourists can still see the old one today. And supposedly it looks kind of creepy. But fortunately, George Washington's skull is still with his body, and there's only the one skull. He doesn't have two.
And you mentioned grave robber attempts on Abraham Lincoln. Yeah. And I'll just sum that up because I want to get to some more modern politics. But Abraham Lincoln's body was moved 16 times to fool thieves and was hidden under a lumber pile. It's kind of crazy the lengths at which people had to go to protect their bodies. I want to tell our listeners, you're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Suzanne Hogan. Today, we're talking about the fates of famous corpses with Bess Lovejoy, author of Rest in Pieces, The Curious Fates of Famous Corpses. You can call in 816-235-2888, 816-235-2888, or email us centralstandard@kcur.org. We're tweeting at KCUR. CST. You see in the book, a dead political leader is an opportunity for major propaganda. And this is so very true in the case of Soviet ruler Vladimir Lenin, who was mummified and put on display after his death. And I was wondering if you could talk about the reasoning for this. Why did this happen to Lenin?
Sure. Well, the interesting thing is, again, this is a story where someone's wishes are not carried out, because Lenin would have been horrified to know that this was happening. He just wanted to be buried next to his mother and sister in St. Petersburg. But Stalin had this idea of mummifying him and sort of permanently embalming him. And there's different speculation about why Stalin chose to do that. But there's been some suggestion that he might have been influenced by the idea of incorruptible corpses, which goes, again, back to Catholicism and also the Orthodox Church. So, and that idea is that a very saintly person will not decay after death. And if you discover a corpse that has refused to decay, you can take that as a kind of miracle and a sign of special significance. And so even though at that point, religion was, you know, the opiate of the masses, and it was not supposed to be widespread in Russia. The populace had been quite religious, and so there was a certain kind of devotion to saints, and that might have influenced Stalin. But certainly, Lenin was a fairly beloved figure at that point, and so this idea that you could keep his body on display forever and turn it into a permanent symbol that people would come and, again, make pilgrimages to was very attractive, and the country was in a lot of tumult at that point. And I think it was thought that it would really be a uniting factor if you could put his body on display and have people come and visit him. And so Stalin did everything he could do to embalm the body, and it took several attempts and kind of a search for a proper scientist who could do this, and certainly a lot of money. But I think it was definitely a very symbolic move on Stalin's part. He was, manipulating the populace, basically.
Eva Perón was another case of that, also known as Evita, the Argentinian wife of ruler Juan Perón. And so she had been sick, and Juan Perón was kind of getting ready for her death in this way. Can you talk a little bit about what happened to Eva Perón? It was kind of similar to Lenin's fate.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Well, it's funny because I think probably Juan Perón wanted something a bit like Lenin to happen, but then her afterlife was much more chaotic. But yeah, while she was dying, and it's not clear to me, other people might know this, other scholars, but I don't know if she knew this was going to happen to her, but she passed away of cancer in her early 30s. And while she was on her deathbed, her husband, Juan Perón, was in touch with this very famous Spanish embalmer who actually actually. Pedro Ara, I believe, was his name, and he used to carry around the preserved head of a peasant in his luggage to show off his skills. I think there's actually a museum devoted to him. But he did what is supposedly an amazing job on Eva Perón's body, filling her with plastic and wax and different chemicals and turning her into a sort of a beautiful little doll. She was quite small at the end of her life. But unfortunately, not long after he had finished this preservation process on her body, Juan Perón was deposed in a coup. So he left the country, but he left his wife's body behind. And it stayed with the embalmer in this government office, and the new military regime kind of left it alone at first. They weren't really sure what to do with it because they were Catholics, and so they couldn't just sort of light the body on fire and you know, cremate it. And at that point, Eva Perón's body would have been pretty flammable. So they could have done that, but they weren't going to. And so they ended up deciding the best thing to do was give her a secret grave. And they put one of the military officers in charge. And there's these conflicting reports, but supposedly he took her body and he intended to bury it. But wherever he took it around the country, he found that people seemed to know where he was going, and that flowers and candles would appear by the van where her body was inside. So he would park it overnight somewhere and, you know, intending to bury her the next morning, wake up and discover the string of candles and flowers. So that really spooked him. His mental health started to suffer, and he ended up putting her body in the attic of his office. And his friends found out, and eventually they're like, this is ridiculous. So they took her body as far away as Italy, and they ended up burying her under a different name. And she finally did rest in Italy for several years. But then, you know, the politics in Argentina kept changing. And eventually Juan Perón was brought back into power. And some new forces in Argentina did go and find the body in Italy. They pretended to be relatives of this made-up, you know, person whose name they had buried her under, got the body back, restored it. Pedro Ara came out of retirement to make the body look new and shiny again. And I think they did put her back on display in Argentina, I think. But fairly soon after that, she was finally given a burial in Buenos Aires in a famous cemetery there. And so she is at rest now, and supposedly her body is under like tons of concrete in a vault that can withstand a nuclear bomb. So no one's going to dig her up again.
Speaking of famous cemeteries, Genevieve writes on Facebook, the Père-Lachaise Cemetery, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, in France, has a lot of famous people buried in it. Jim Morrison, Chopin, Oscar Wilde are the most memorable. Hundreds of fresh kisses all over his tombstone. It was quite a sight. And what's interesting about that cemetery is the reason it became famous was because of the French playwright Molière, who is not buried there. What happened there?
Yeah, Molière is an interesting story, and I just want to say Père Lachaise is wonderful, and if any of your listeners get a chance to go to Paris and they have any interest in cemeteries, they should not miss that. And I went to Oscar Wilde's grave, and I did plant a lipstick kiss on it myself, which might be seen as an act of vandalism, so I hope I don't get into trouble saying that. And there's now plastic over his statue, so you can no longer kiss it, unfortunately. But the story with Molière is that when Père Lachaise was built, it was sort of considered in the suburbs of Paris, so it was a bit of a stretch to go out there, and people were used to burying their dead in more central locations. And so the promoter of Père Lachaise decided that a good way of getting people to want to bury their dead in the cemetery was to dig up, you know, to get some famous bodies in there. And one of the bodies that he went after was Molière's. But Molière, because he was an actor, so back in 17th century France, acting was considered a really morally suspect profession. And if you wanted to be buried in, you know, in a Christian cemetery, you needed to renounce your profession before you died, so you could be buried as a regular individual, not a horrible actor. But Molière didn't have time. He died pretty quickly, so he never renounced his profession. And his widow had to really pull some strings to get him a proper Christian burial. And she was able to do that, but no one was quite clear on where he was buried in this cemetery in Paris. And so Not long after he died, the French Revolution came along. Molière's body was actually dug up because a section of Paris wanted to name itself after Molière, and they wanted to have his body. So they dug him up, but no one really knew where he was, and so the officers sent to dig him up kind of threw their hands up and said, well, we'll just dig anywhere and say that this body is Molière's and call it a day. And those are the bones that ended up in Père Lachaise, but there's really no one has any certainty that those bones are Molière's, and quite likely they're not his at all. But that burial and other burials, famous individuals in Père Lachaise, did help make the cemetery quite popular. And now there's absolutely thousands of graves there, and it's this sort of beautiful city of the dead. So it was a successful move on the part of the promoter, definitely.
I want to quickly get to some unconventional graves, that of Timothy Leary, Hunter S. Thompson, totally different, but kind of similar in this eccentric idea of a great last wish. Can you talk about Timothy Leary and Hunter S. Thompson and their kind of final wishes and how they were acted out?
Sure. And those stories were intriguing to me because as you get further into the 20th century, you get these people with very individualistic last wishes. So they had no interest in kind of going along in a more conventional way. And Hunter S. Thompson is a good example of that. And there's actually a BBC documentary from the 70s where you can see Hunter S. Thompson, while he is still very much alive, talking about what he wants done after his death. And his plan was to build a giant cannon out in his home in Colorado. I think there's a kind of valley or some beautiful expanse of land more or less in his backyard, and he wanted to build a cannon there topped with a giant gonzo fist, and the gonzo fist was his personal symbol. And some of your listeners may know that gonzo is this type of like first person wild journalism that Hunter S. Thompson more or less invented, and this gonzo fist, which is just a regular fist, would be clutching a peyote button because Hunter S. Thompson was pretty fond of peyote. And inside would be a cannon, as I said, that would have Hunter S. Thompson's cremated remains mixed with fireworks. And these would explode out of the cannon into the night sky while Mr. Tambourine Man was playing, and a whole, you know, hundreds of Hunter S. Thompson's closest friends were there to celebrate him. So this was his last wish. And in this BBC documentary, which I think might just be called Fear and Loathing on the Road to Las Vegas, it's from 1978, you can see him in a Hollywood mortuary trying to explain this to a funeral director who's trying to play along. But it was really expensive, and Hunter S. Thompson didn't really have the money to do this. So it was never quite clear who was going to pay for this massive party and the gonzo fist and the fireworks until Johnny Depp came along, and the two of them got to be friends, and they had hung out while Johnny Depp was getting ready to play Hunter S. Thompson. And so he stepped forward after Thompson's suicide and ponied up the millions of dollars that it took to do this. So I can't remember when it happened, but sometime in the late 2000s, there was this massive all-night-long party with this beautiful giant statue of the gonzo fist clutching the peyote button, and Hunter S. Thompson's cremated remains shooting out into the night sky, and it was a big party. And that's actually the last story in the book, and it was the last story that I wrote, and I kind of liked ending on that the sort of celebration note.
Thank goodness for Johnny Depp. Well, thank you so much, Best Love, Joy. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you. I didn't even get a chance to talk about so many others. There's so many great people that you talk about in the book. Rest in Peace is The Curious Fates of Famous Corpses. Thank you, Best Love, Joy, for joining us from KUOW in Seattle. You can find out more information about Best Love, Joy and her book on our website at kcur.org. Tune in tomorrow for Central Standard, a look at the stars, you know, the kind in the skies, and some philosophy. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and myself. Up to Date is next with comedian Yakov Smirnoff. I'm Suzanne Hogan, and this is Central Standard on KCUR. Enjoy the day.